Blog Talk Radio.
Got on the air. Hi there. This is Fran Lewis, and we have a really exciting show today. Unfortunately, the weather has turned bad. It's going to rain any minute. And just let me tell my guests that if anyone happens to get bumped off because of the weather or whatever, just call back in and pray that we get this show on the road. It's going to be a lot of fun. So, everybody, welcome to Mystery Thriller Thursday. And let me introduce my very special, talented authors and guests. We have the author of Bad Intent, Midnight Seasons, and tons more, former FBI agent Michael Tabman. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Fran. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm hanging in there.
All right.
And we have the queen of mystery and comedy, straight from Canada, by the author of Daytona Dead, and you better watch out when you get in the car with her. Karen Vaughn is here. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
You never know. And we have the author of Mad Dog House, and soon to coming out in September, and I've already read it. You're going to want to put a pre-order on this one. Love Gone Mad, Dr. Mark Rubenstein's here. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Fran. I dropped the doctor. It's just Mark.
Oh, okay. I will. And we're supposed to have one more guest, but Stuart Yates is supposed to call in from Spain. And I guess maybe there's a problem. So we'll just get started with everyone that's here, and we will hope that we don't get interrupted by the weather. And I want to just say hi to Delaney and hi to Christina. Hi, guys. It's nice to have you listening in. Delaney is in charge of Red River Writers, and she's taken over for April, and Christina's part of that, too, and Serial Authors. So hi, guys. Okay, Mark, you want to tell everybody a little bit about Love Gone Mad, and we'll just go around and talk about your books for a couple of minutes?
Is that me, Fran? Did you ask?
Yeah, Mark.
Sure. Love Gone Mad is it's sort of Stephen King meets John Grisham in its own way. It's part legal thriller, part Halloween. It's really a story about what happens when one falls into the ultimate delusion, namely love. And when love goes bad, terrible things can happen. And it's about a young surgeon and a young nurse who meet at a hospital, and Megan Haggerty's past comes back to haunt both of them. And I don't know if I ought to say much more about it, Fran.
We don't want to give anything away. Karen, would you tell everybody about Daytona Dad?
Daytona Dead is the third in my Laura and Jerry series. They finally got married. They're on their way to have just arrived in Daytona, Florida. And right away they run into a little bit of roadkill problem, which happens to be her ex-husband, Lou. And things just start rolling from there. And then they discover there's a killer race car driver out there with a bad attitude.
You definitely want to read it because, you know, you never know what's going to happen when you read a Karen Vaughn murder. I mean, really.
Plus, it's
hilarious to start with. And, Mike, would you tell everybody about my favorite handsome cop besides you, Mark Zuccarelli?
Very, very well done. Touché.
I did that right.
Yeah, you did. Mark Zuccarelli is fashioned by my old partner back in New York City in the 90s. We worked the crime families together. But actually, back in Bad Intent, this is based on the drug wars back in the 90s. And I brought him sort of into that scenario and his very colorful personality.
See, nobody's giving anything away.
I'll tell you, Bad Intent is really, it's about the drug wars. But it has to do with the mob and the Colombian cartels, NYPD, FBI, and all the dynamics and politics that went into the drug wars at the time.
Well, before I go into the questions that I'm going to ask, I promised myself I wouldn't mess up this time, and I would give my picks of the week before I start. I would like to dedicate this show to one of the authors whose book I read, and the reason I'm doing that is because the name of the book is The Odd Couple and the Little Dog by Honey B. Morins. Honey emailed me on May 9th to please read her book, And at that time, she had someone send me the book a week later, and unfortunately, honey passed away before she could read my review. And her family thought that my review was wonderful, and I'm hoping that everybody will get a copy of her book. It's about an elderly couple and a little chihuahua that actually takes up all of their time and brings them together, brings their life back together after their son commits suicide. It's really sad. So at the end of the book, it says, the name of the dog is Chi-Chi. Chi-Chi settles in her chair but suddenly sits up. She wags her tail in greeting as Wally joins us and sits. I don't know if he was waiting or if he just arrived. It really doesn't matter because the odd couple and the little dog are together in paradise. So this one's for you, honey. And the other books that you might want to read, and they're fantastic, brand-new author, Sebastian by Christoph Fischer. Absolutely fantastic. The Suicide Club, coming out in September by Jean Toulet. One of our favorite authors, Rick Austin, In the Shadow of Elvis. That was some book. And Journal of a Russian Businessman, Minus 40 Degrees, True Story of a Ponzi Scheme When This Guy Got Scammed, and he'll tell you he did, by Dmitry Potsky. Okay, now I have a question for anybody that wants to answer it, and anyone could take it. This is why this is Mystery Thursday, and whoever wants to answer, that's great. When deciding on the primary topic for your novel and a specific area that you want to write on, a specific setting, how do you decide that?
I'll take that then, because mine's pretty easy.
Okay.
I base it on my life experience. My books are based on my years on the police department and the FBI, and after 27 years, I should hope I have a few stories to tell.
You have a lot of stories to tell.
I do.
I can answer that as well, perhaps a bit differently. As a psychiatrist, I've listened for more years than I can count by now to other people's stories, some of which have been horrific, others of which have been uplifting, and integrating those stories with stories of my own and with letting my imagination run a little bit rampant. I always say that writing is the only career I know where I can commit mayhem, murder, and all kinds of mischief without going to prison. I put it all together, and out comes a story.
That's an interesting way to put it. And Karen, how did you decide on the race cars this time, the racetrack?
I don't know. I just decided I wanted to do something different, take them on their honeymoon, and they're kind of race car, like NASCAR fans in a way. So I thought, well, why not take them on a trip where they can go and see a couple races, but what they don't count on is Killer T. Ford getting in their faces. So that makes it all the more interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, what did you need to know about race car racing in order to write this particular one?
I don't really think I needed to know a whole heck of a lot, except for who the other racers were, like real life racers, like Jeff Gordon, Kyle Busch, Danica Patrick, you know, anybody that would be like more real life racers, and then throw the fictional character of Killer T in with his like diva attitude. I'm sure there are a few race car drivers out there that have the big attitude.
I'm definitely sure that a lot of them have a big attitude. I know I don't drive a car, but when I was younger, my father actually let me do stock car racing. So when I was reading this, I was like, Kevin, this is so much fun. It just brought back old memories of not getting behind the wheel because you wouldn't want me to be in front of one. Okay.
You know, Fran, your question to Karen really brings up the whole issue of research. You know, how much, if any,
good
research does anybody do when writing fiction?
That was my next question, so go ahead.
How do you like that?
Not bad. Go ahead.
I try to do as little research as I can. Obviously, there are things that you have to actually research. I try to use basically what I know about life and people, but there are little things that can make a difference in terms of putting fiction across with a level of authenticity that I might otherwise be lacking. If I can give you just a small example, I was once writing a scene. Yeah, I was writing a scene about a woman sitting at a bar and drinking a martini. And I, as I was writing, I indicated that she was lifting up this martini glass, and I said to myself, my God, everybody knows what a martini glass is. It's that long stem thing that's shaped like a V at the top. But I'm sure there's another name for it. And I went online and I looked up martini glass, and I learned, among many other things, that in 1889 at the Savoy Hotel, this glass was invented by somebody specifically for the martini, and really it's technically called the Savoy glass. So I called it a Savoy glass. It's little details like that that can make a difference in terms of the whether the telling of the tale seems artifactual or really on target.
That is so true, because a lot of times some of the research, and I do, when somebody does do a lot of research, historical Vietnam especially, I will look up the time period and I'll look up the person that they're talking about to make sure that the research is correct before I review the book. I know I shouldn't, but I do. What can I say? And, well, Mike, you don't have to do too much research on drugs, but you do know all of it, right?
Well, actually, you know, I'm kind of in the opposite situation. I find that I'm too careful in trying to remain close to fact. And I'm awfully happy to be cautioned that this is fiction, it's a novel. You can get a little bit into fantasy. You don't have to have everything exactly correct.
Yeah, yeah.
Every police procedure doesn't have to be right. It doesn't have to be according to any law. So I find myself doing the opposite, trying to let myself get a little bit away from reality, a little away from the truth.
We have a whole bunch of people in the chat room that would like a Savoy glass, Mark. They would prefer if you would just send them one with a martini in it.
With a martini in it, okay. Guaranteed not to get the envelope wet. I agree with what was just said. I really do. I my excuse for when I get things a little bit factually incorrect is, hey, it's just fiction. You know, I'm just writing a story here. If I don't have every single detail completely accurate, it really shouldn't matter if the tale is a good one and the characters have depth.
You know, I agree with you too, but you know, the thing I worry about is if I say something really outrageous about a police procedure or law, I just don't want to lose my own credibility with my audience.
Sure.
These are things that I should just know.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm in a different boat than you are. I don't have to worry about that.
I'm just hoping that my readers aren't really paying that much close attention, that if I do mess up, hey. You
know,
it's
you and I are, Karen, you and I are in the same boat. We're in the same boat. I hope
so. And I'm lazy.
Well, I am too. As a matter of fact, someone pointed out to me in an unfinished script that my time frames were way off. I said, oh, is that so? So I had to revamp the entire time frame of the novel because by page 300, it was in a different month, actually, than on page 50.
Well, Mike knows. I've done that for him, and I've done that for a few other people. And
yes,
if the time frame is off, yes. But you know what? You have to gently tell the person that the time frame is off. And you want to I told somebody last week that I thought, he asked me if I liked the title of his book, and I gave him 10 titles that I thought were better. And
Fran, I don't remember your comments being gentle, though.
But
your comments, they weren't gentle, but
gentle.
They were not with me.
Hey, I wanted to call
not to be too evil.
I wanted to call Daytona Dead, actually Dead Tourist in the Middle of the Road, and someone told me it was too long.
No, you can't do that.
You could have just called it Roadkill.
Well,
there's another book out there called Roadkill by Willie Nelson.
Oh,
so.
Oh, there is a book.
Our author for Roadkill just showed up. Hold on a minute.
Oh.
Okay, hold. Stuart, is that you?
Hello, Fran, it is.
Oh, my goodness, that's goodness. You're the last. I didn't know if you knew. Okay, everybody, you just said Roadkill. Well, the author of Roadkill is right here. Ha, huh? How do you like
that? Okay, so that's another reason why I can't call it Roadkill.
You can, because Stuart's book is Roadkill, and he just called in. Where are you, in Spain?
I am in Spain at the moment, Fran, yes.
Oh, okay. We're talking about what kind of research goes into writing your novel, and how do you decide the setting? And I just started Roadkill, and I'm scared just by reading the first chapter. Sorry.
How did I go about? I don't know how I went about doing it. I used to work on Bodmin Moor in a school, and Bodmin Moor is in Cornwall in the UK, and it was just the most amazing place, and it's always stayed with me. The resonance and the mystery of it, it's got something very, very special. And when I came up with this story, I just decided to set it there because it just seemed to fit exactly into the sort of story I was trying to write.
Well, I just started it, and I read the more, and that's enough to tell me I had to put the book down because I was getting nervous. No, it's really good. No, seriously. It's really good. I have 35 books inside. I counted them just before, which really got me nervous. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to pick the ones that have the largest print, the nicest covers, and don't have 700 pages. So what can I say? Okay, my next question to everybody is seriously. So Timothy Lewis Baker, if you're listening, just know that your book has less than 100 pages, and I started that. I started 7 books today. That just tells you, what can I tell you? When creating your main characters for any of your novels, how do you decide on the character's primary traits? And do you mirror your characters or character after real people or even yourself?
Yes, I do.
Go on.
More is basically me.
I would think so.
Only about 14 years younger. And a lot skinnier. But she's got my attitude, my sense of humor, so watch out.
Wait till she sees what I did to her and faces 3. She's got, I hope she still has a sense of humor.
I'm very, what very, can very I say? Afraid. I'm very nervous, but I'm sure you did me well.
As long as I die a good death,
I'm really happy.
What can I say? I'll even let Karen give a blurb for the back of the book if she likes it. That's the least I could do for killing her off. What can I tell you? So anybody else, when
you want to kill somebody off in one of my books too? So I haven't decided how you're going to do that yet.
I'm going to help you. This is good. And I told you I want to be, you know, I want to be a character in somebody's book, and I want to be bad because it's my natural personality to be evil. So that's good. So anybody else, when you created your characters in your novels, how do you decide on the character's primary traits, whether they're good or whether they're evil or whether they're a combination of both?
I'll take that. You know, in my course of time, just in the FBI, I worked on squads with maybe 20, 30 guys and gals. So I had a whole host of characters from which to choose. So my characters are based on, or at least inspired by, those people I met. Maybe not characteristic for characteristic, but I'll get a general idea of whom I'm modeling the character after. And I'll take some of the characteristics. And I may take some of my own and put them in a very minor character. Because I don't want the book to be about me. It's fiction. So I'll do that. And even the criminals will be based on the criminals we've arrested. They were very interesting characters as well. And when we sat down and interviewed them or met them in an undercover capacity, we learned a lot about them. And I remember some of those fascinating traits and stories and personalities. So I use them as well.
Okay, Mike, just for that, I'm going to send you Faces 3 before I have it published so you can tell me what I did wrong.
All right, you got it.
There are a lot of criminals. Go on, Mark.
I'll be gentle.
I'm not sure if being a psychiatrist is a help or a hindrance in this area, because when I create characters, I don't know that I have any one specific in mind. I know that bits and parts of myself come out in, let's say, the protagonist. Also, bits and pieces of who I might like to be or wish I could be will come out. Those parts of me that were frustrated and never got to do certain things are expressed through the character. And that's probably the case for most of us. I think my characters are an amalgam of myself, of other people, of traits and characteristics that I either have or wish I had or that I loathe. It's very difficult to really pin it all down. I try not to create stick figures, and I try to give every character, or at least the main characters, a good deal of depth and get inside their heads. But, of course, that's what I've been doing with patients for so many years. So maybe it's just a bad or possibly a good habit, but I do it all the time.
Yeah, I'd like to agree with that, actually. I think that's very true. For me, personally, it's not one particular thing that I would hone in on anybody I know. or even myself, even though in Roadkill, the hero, if you like, is a school teacher. And I actually taught on Bodmin Moor at that time. So he's, in that sort of sense, he could well be framed as being me. But he's nothing like me as a person. And Ralph, the killer, he's not like anybody I've ever met. He's just... But I think the last speaker, forgive me, I don't know who it was, but that is absolutely spot on. As an author, you take so many bits and pieces from so many different people that you meet. It's just, it's that combining of all those different facets of a person's character which makes us writers and makes us creative. And that for me is really, well, it's quite an amazing journey for me, actually. So, yeah, I agree with that, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I can only tell you, more than one person has said to me after reading Mad Dog House, they said, Mark, what kind of background did you come from? They were assuming I was writing about myself, and it was just amazing how people will assume that a writer is writing about himself or herself. And God, if I was like Roddy Dolan, I wouldn't be where I am now. I would have long ago been dead, or I'd have been rotting away in prison.
Absolutely, absolutely. People say, they say to me, they get really shocked. I never knew you were like that.
That's
like,
right.
It's not me. I'm creating these characters. It's a fiction, you know? So it's, I can understand that. Absolutely, yeah.
I have a lot of fun creating the victims and the villains in my story, because they're like, people have said, can you kill off so-and-so? Or I want to be the victim. I have a friend who I knew when I was writing Dead Comic Standing. Oh, kill me off. So I created Jason in the story and killed him off really violently. And then I had another friend who said, can you kill off my ex-husband, Lou? So that's Lou in Daytona Dead is actually the same name as her ex-husband. So she was really happy when I killed off Lou. And I'm thinking about killing off a former employer and my ex-husband and another friend's ex-husband are going to be amalgamated into one character for another book at the big time. So
I can give you a couple, Karen, also that can we can get rid of also. Would any of you ever want to be the main character and use your own name in a book as maybe the person that solves the crime or something like that? And how would you handle something like that? I just thought of that.
I don't think I would want to. I enjoy just playing the author in the background and creating this fantasy, and just so my readers enjoy the story for the story. I wouldn't want to put myself out there.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. Yeah.
I think as a writer, we're putting ourselves out there anyway, because everything we write comes from within us, and they're bits, pieces, parcels, and particles of who and what we are. And I think every writer, in a sense, and I hate to get psychiatric about this, but we're all a little bit exhibitionistic, and we all show ourselves maybe without even intending to do so. So, but I wouldn't want to name myself present myself as a character in a book. It's so much more effective to hide behind my characters.
So many that there are people that have done that. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. Well, friend, in my case,
thought that it was the wrong move.
People always think it is me because I'm writing about crime, so they think it is me. So I like to leave at least a little mystery and say maybe. I'll leave them guessing at least.
Yeah. But Karen brought up an interesting point.
Yeah, go ahead.
Karen's point was very interesting, that some people want to see a character killed off, others don't. As I think you know, Fran, after Mad Dog House, I went on to Love Gone Mad, but I've just put the finishing touches on Mad Dog Justice, because so many people who read Mad Dog House said, where's the sequel? What's coming next?
Uh-huh.
Because there's unfinished business.
Oh, that would be good. I love it.
Yeah, and Roddy and Danny, they did this, that, and the other thing, but, you know, what's going to happen next? And I found myself sort of revivifying and not being able to put to bed these two guys. And I just finished page 339 or whatever it is on the manuscript, and now, of course, comes the rewriting. But sometimes you just can't kill off the character. Your readers don't want you to. They won't even let you.
No, and you're going to have to write a sequel to the other one, too. I'm just telling you right now, before we even start, you have to write another one to Love Gone Mad, because you left that sort of the same way. Okay, that's all I'll say. Okay, next question. When you create a conflict in your book that your main character needs to handle, do you play some authors make it too easy for them to handle the problem and not enough obstacles? Some authors put a lot of obstacles in their way. How do you handle placing obstacles in their way without having the character fall short of what you think he or she should be in that story?
Well, you know, in my stories, these obstacles are usually obstacles that we did face during the course of the day when trying to get the cases worked. So I just try, again, those are the kind of matters I was talking about before, but I try to keep it real. I try to remember what the obstacles were. They were political, legal, interpersonal matters on the squad, cops versus FBI, you know, cops versus criminal. And I try to use that. And then I want to make sure they resolve it within the context of the personality that I put out there in the story. I don't like, you know, super humans, you know, solving things. It's not superheroes. I like them to get their bumps and bruises along the way and then resolve the way we would have if the story was taking place.
Well, that makes sense, because even police today don't find it that easily, and they don't solve a case right away. And if you make it too easy, I begin to wonder, like, you know, did it really happen? Anybody
yeah.
else?
Yeah.
When you find an obstacle in poor Laura, she poor thing, in her way, and you did so many rotten things to her on her honeymoon that we won't share, why did you put so many obstacles, and why did you, you know, decide to take her? Why did you pick her honeymoon anyway?
Why did I pick her honeymoon?
Yeah, why did you pick her honeymoon with the poor guy who was finally going to have some fun, and you just, what can I say?
I know. I went and killed it because, you know, my first honeymoon, when I got married to my daughter's father, was not exactly the easiest either, but it was interesting. I just thought, yeah, it was interesting, and that you will see probably in Jamaica Den. That's all I'm saying right now. I like throwing curves at people. And
yeah, you do.
The fact that I invented this guy, Dave Meacham, which at the first was a real creepazoid, and then ended up having some redeeming qualities after having an epiphany of, like, I don't want to live like this anymore. I don't want to be his yes man. Here I go. I'm going to rat him out.
Well,
I think obstacles are as much psychological as they are real. I mean, to me, the essence of good storytelling involves not just placing obstacles in the protagonist's path, but also, and even more so, conflict and ambiguity. The character doesn't know necessarily what's going to happen next, and of course, nor does the reader. And conflict, and I mean, I try never to relinquish suspense. Suspense, in my view, equals conflict and doubt or ambiguity. I try not to have a novel either as it's progressing along in its story or even at the end have a neat, clean, completely tied up package. Always leave some seed of doubt there so the reader hopefully can think about it and wonder.
I have a question from the chat room.
I think that's a good point there. It's the old cliche, isn't it? The cliffhanger, but I think that's quite an important point, because if sometimes you've got to hook your reader in, and you can do that from the beginning, obviously, but at the end as well, you always want to leave them just that little question. Ooh, I wonder what's going to happen now, or, you know, and I like that. I like that about a book. I like to finish a book thinking, you know, what is the next thing? What's the next terrible event that's going to happen to this person? Because my characters are usually quite, they're normal. They're just normal people, but they're put in extraordinary situations, and how they deal with that is very much, I mean, it's real. I try to write as real, as truthfully as I can, and I don't want my characters to be too overblown, too fantastic or brilliant in any sense, just that so people can relate to them. These are ordinary people, and it's the same in Roadkill, where the school teacher is just an ordinary guy, but he's totally out of his depth. He doesn't know what to do, and he's manipulated. He's manipulated by everybody who he meets. And I like that. I like that. How on earth does he get through? How does an ordinary person just survive? And I like that. And that's what I tend to focus on.
You definitely do. And you know what? To every one of your books, Stuart, I always say, what would happen if there was another chapter? What would happen if he wrote another
cool.
page?
I mean, let's face it, life itself is filled with loose ends and unfinished
yep.
business. And even if you're
Absolutely.
Writing a standalone novel, you know, the old Hollywood ending or the old fairy tale ending, and they lived happily ever after, I don't think audiences today really go for that. I think they want a little bit more complexity.
Yeah.
Yes.
I agree.
They always want the sequel. I have a question from Delaney, and Delaney would like to know, guys, how do you keep your plot moving, and do you ever find yourself walking into a wall?
Walking into a what?
Walking into
a wall.
Walking
into a wall. At a dead end. She would like to know, how do you keep your plot moving? In other words, how come I could read your book in an hour and not want to put it down, which is true, and like all of them, and do you ever find yourself walking into a wall like you don't know where to go with it?
That's never happened to me, I've got to say. I immerse myself totally in the story, and it just flows. And I see it. I see it being played out in my mind as if I'm watching a movie. And once I begin, I can't stop. So it's with me all the time. And everything is just brimming over all the time. I have a very rough plan that I tend to follow step by step, but essentially it just takes me off, you know, and I don't have that. I don't know why I don't have that, but I don't, and I just thoroughly enjoy it. It's fabulous.
Anybody else?
I'll jump in there. I also operate on a rough plan of where I want to go, and it kind of just flows. But I find times when I'm heading down a path where I decide I don't like it, or I feel it's illogical based on something I've already written, and so I'll just change it around. That's the beauty of being an author and writing fiction. I just change it to fit where I wanted to go. But like the previous speaker, I just work on a rough plan. I'm not dedicated to an absolute outcome.
Well, I'm going to ask Karen. Karen, what's that favorite question that you always ask? Do you write with an outline, or you just or are you a pantser and you just keep writing? Is that your favorite question?
Yeah, I'm a basic pantser. I go where my characters tell me to go, which could be a few places, but anyway. And I recently in the project I'm working now, first of all, thought, oh, I'm going to get Laura pregnant now. And my editor said, no, it's too soon for her to get pregnant. And so I turned around and said, okay, she's not pregnant anymore. So that can wait, you know. But mostly I go with the flow where my gut tells me to go with the story.
You sound like Iris Johansson, who said to me, so the characters tell her how to end the book. They sort of rule what she's going to do, but she never gives away anything about the book. What can I say? So how do you keep a reader's interest for 300 pages? Now, as a reviewer, and you all know I know how to do that vaguely, I've read over 1,000 books. I've actually counted, which is really frightening. And there are some books that are 50 pages, and there are some books that are 800 too long. And then there are some books that are just exactly right, like all of yours. how do you know? Is 300 pages too long? Or how do you keep a reader's interest? And how do you know when it's time to say, it's enough and I'm done?
Wow, that's a great question. I don't know. is my answer. I don't know. I just write. And
okay.
If it's 300 pages, it's 300 pages. If it's 150, it's 150. And I just write. And as long as I've got the enthusiasm for the story, which I have for the most part,
it just seems to
become its own thing. So
how long does it take you to write one? How long does it take you to write a whole book?
Me? I usually write in the evenings or the weekend because I work or in my holidays. But it will take me to write my first draft of maybe 50 to 60,000 words. It will take me about 3 weeks.
Oh, that makes me feel bad. It took me forever to write this last one. What about you, the rest of you? How long does it take you to write a whole book?
Fran, as you know, my first two books I wrote in 6 months, but that was under unusual circumstances. I just retired, and both my feet were in surgical boots, so I had nowhere to go and no one to see. So those went rather quickly. Bad intent took me over the course of several months because now I'm working. I have a consulting business and I'm doing other things and still have kids at home at the time. And so it was just a little different than when I wrote the first two books. But as far as how do you keep the readers engaged, that's something I think I was hoping you're doing as you're writing the story. And then, boy, I hope this is interesting. I hope it's keeping my readers engaged.
Yeah, I would add on that it's a difficult question to answer. How do you keep readers engaged, and how do you know when you've done enough? I think going back to what I said before, and what I think is really very true, you have to keep the suspense, at least in this kind of novel. You've got to keep the suspense alive. Elmore Leonard said rather famously, "I just cut out the parts that people skip." I don't do that, although sometimes the editor starts to do that, and I do find that there are times I get lost in some cul-de-sacs because I'm so taken up with a particular description or whatever. And there's one other thing, in terms of how long is long enough, I don't know why I developed this strange notion that about 80,000 words is really a good length for a novel, and I try to stick to approximately that length, which translates loosely to maybe 300, 320 pages of actual book. I think books that are 400 pages or more, or 375 or more, some readers are just intimidated by the number of pages. I don't know if that's true, really, but that's just my gut feeling, and I try to tell the story as richly as I can and as economically as I can, and keep the suspense and the not knowing, a slight grayness of vagueness, just keep propelling the reader along. I think the operative phrase is, what's going to happen next?
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. That is true, because if I figure out who did it at the beginning of the book or what's going to happen, that's bad. And on long time, I sometimes do. And I have, like I said, I have over 30 books staring at me inside. And when I look at something that's like 600 pages or 500 pages, it may be a very, very good novel. It may be great. And I'll just say, well, I'm going to be the one that's 300 pages first.
That's right. Yeah, I do the same thing. I'm intimidated when I see a 450, 480-page book. Unless it's Tolstoy, I turn away. And I believe in the law of large numbers. You know, we all think we're so unique, but we're very much like other people. And if I'm doing it, I'm sure other people are doing it.
Yeah, it becomes difficult to take 600 pages, and make a book review that's not 9,000 words, and you don't want to do that. You don't want to go between 1,400 and 1,500 words, and it makes it hard. I'm reading Bunker Hill. That's my next one after Timothy's book, and it's pretty long. It's interesting. It's a phenomenal book. It's a lot of history, and I'm just trying to figure out how to condense, 400 and some odd pages into 1,200 words. since Nathaniel Philbrick's publicist sent me the book, I truly hope that they read it after when I'm finally done. Now I have another question, people, based on editing and stuff. When you read your book, Roger Ellery said 2 weeks ago that he prints does something that I pretty much do also. I can't read on my computer. I get eye strain. So after you read your book and you completed it, when you correct it, before you send it to the editor that tells you you made mistakes or whatever has to be done, do you print it out or do you read it on your computer or both?
I can answer that one easy. I print it out. I must look at it on paper.
Okay. Anybody else?
I read it on the computer. And then I send it to my editor, and I actually get my husband to read it, see if there's anything both Irma and I missed. And then I just make corrections as I go.
Mm-hmm.
I do the same thing, except I don't send it to my husband. I send it to my wife. I give it to my wife. She reads it. She beats me up over it. I go back on the computer. I make some changes, make some deletions and some additions. Then I send it to the editor, and then she beats me up.
Well, my editor is really good, Maxine, but the problem is my husband hasn't read any one of my 10 books yet. And neither has my brother, neither has anybody. My family doesn't read as much as I do. And
that's
interesting
because very few, my daughter reads my books, but nobody else has from my family. And I wonder about that sometimes. Why not? And my daughter reads them, and she thinks they're great. But that is a strange thing. I don't know why that is. But I normally just read my stories off the screen, I usually get a friend of mine who reads them for me, and she makes lots of suggestions, which is really good. Then the editor comes back, and we work together on it, and we do it all via the net. So it's very ecological, Fran. Very ecological.
Now it's amazing because I wrote, like I said, 10 books, and a lot of people have read them and said they're really great. And my nephews they'll call me and say, did you read this novel? Because we're going to do an essay in about 10 minutes, so you better download it or something, because we're going to read it together. I mean, it's not like they don't read. That happened last week, for real. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, whatever you want to know, I read it real fast. But they don't read my work, and I guess they don't realize, what I've done. And other people, I got a 5-star review for my memories book this morning. I had no idea that the author read the book, that anybody read it. And I emailed it to my brother, and I said, isn't this great? I got a 5-star review on the memoirs of my mom's story that I wrote 4 years ago. And he said, I'll wait for the movie. I said, well, who's playing Mom? And he said, maybe I will. I go, no, I thought maybe Reese Witherspoon or Meryl Streep. What can I say? No, it's amazing because I think I don't claim to be great, but the books I wrote, my editor passed away was my sister. And my sister was the one that read everything, and she read it with a critical eye. She would be somebody that you would want to read your book because she would definitely rip it apart and say and tell you how to fix it, which is great. Which leads me to
Fran, it brings to mind an issue that sort of bugs me. I have 8 readers that I have used over the course of now 3 books, and I've found that they're all friends or relatives, and I've found that it's very difficult to get real friends and relatives who care about you to be brutally honest. And that's the big drawback in depending on friends or relatives. I have one friend, and I said... So-and-so, you're a great friend because you've told me that this stinks, and nobody else has told me that, and you pointed out why, and you're right. And most people who know you well and who care about you they don't want to hurt your feelings, quote-unquote, and they will not tell you the real hardcore truth, and what you need from feedback is that truth,
you're right.
That's where you're better off not depending on friends and relatives.
Oh, I didn't want to depend on them to tell me what was wrong with the book. I just wanted them to read it when it came out.
Yeah.
Oh, that's another thing.
You know, it's funny because my postman has read it. I gave him a copy, and the bakery guys read it, and I gave it to my next door neighbor to read the book about my sister and myself. And I didn't ask my brother to read it and rip it apart because forget it. It would never get done. It would never get printed. But I just said to him, wouldn't you like to read about the stories that I wrote about, you know, Marcia and I growing up? And he says, no, I'll wait for the movie for that come out. That comes out too. So what can I say? So when you read your book, do you read it as a reader that will be reading your book or as a reviewer to give yourself a critical eye?
I do.
Ah, good. Go on.
I basically say, okay, I'm going to read it as not me. I'm going to say, if I were reading this book, who would I cast as the main person if it were a movie? Because I do that with everybody else's book anyway, so why not do it with my own? And I try really hard to be critical and say, oh, I missed that there, or I got to go back and change that because it doesn't fit with the other scene, or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I try and say, okay, I'm going to have to tell her she needs to do this.
By the way, Karen, I just downloaded Daytona Dead.
Oh, thank you.
Uh-oh.
I love you, Mark.
Yeah,
I can't stand reading my own book.
I have three others.
I know, but I'm going to look. That's the problem I ran into. It's not a problem. That's an issue I ran into when I did the sequel to Mad Dog House, when I did Mad Dog Justice. How much do I assume the person who's reading the second book has read the first book and you know, or has not read the first book, and do I want to bore the person who has read the first book by recapitulating things in that book? Yet the new reader who hasn't read the first one has to have some of the background and the backstory, otherwise he's going to pick up in the middle of God knows what. So it's a very delicate balance you got to take.
Yep.
And I just downloaded Daytona Dead, and I haven't read the first two, and I'm going to read this third one, Daytona Dead, and I can only ask Karen, will I be coming in the middle of something that I'm just lost in, or will it will the backstory be available to me?
I give a little bit of a backstory about what happened in Over Her Dead Body.
Mm-hmm.
I point out how it all started in Dead on Arrival, which I would probably end up having to send to you because it's not online. But basically, I give a little bit of a backstory so you're not completely lost. You know.
So it's a standalone novel on its own, even though it is part of a series.
Yeah. This is like this. They got married at the end of the last book, and this is their honeymoon. And you don't need to know a lot about what happened. I give little hints along the way about how they had to deal with a murderous bimbo in the last one, and how, you know, she had been working with Lou in the last one, and how Lou's her ex-husband and everything. But that's all you really need to know, because it goes on from there. So
That's great. Getting back
I try not to bore people with a lot of backstory.
Getting back to the question Fran asked about reading your own novel in finished form, you know, after it's out, I can't stand doing it because I start by page one. I already see a couple of things that I could have done better, you know, and it just drives me nuts. So I can't take it. I just can't tolerate it. It has to be, you know, at some point you got to give it up and let it be what it is. And if I read it again, I'm going to find 1,000 things I don't like.
I've always said that if I had the chance, I'd rewrite them all. I'd rewrite them all again.
Oh, that was my next question. Oh, thank you. That was my next question. If you could, it's right here in front of me with a whole bunch of more questions. If you could change something about your book or rewrite it, what would you change and what would you rewrite?
Well, for me, like I'll carry on. I think, with all of them, I look at them very critically, and I think the very first book I had published, which is called Cold Helen Darley Dean, that wasn't written. I used a different name for that, Glenn Stewart, but that was a very personal book. And since I mean, it was very moving to write for me to get that down. And it was about a lot of things, very personal things. But after I'd read it, after it came out, it was published, and I read it, I thought, oh, if only I'd done a little bit more. Because it's not a huge book. It's about 40,000 words. And if I was to rewrite it now, I'd probably double that, because there's so much in there that I want to just build on and just really, really make it more personal again. So, yeah, I do that with all my books. I see everything. I think, oh, I could do that better. I want to do this. I want to add bits more to it and whatever, all the time. So, never stops.
Okay, so everybody's main character has some strengths and flaws. Would you change, if you rewrote the books to it, or anybody rewrote their book, would you change something about your main character?
Or create
a different outcome in your novel?
Well, in Roadkill, I did change the end. I had this end in mind. I normally do have the end in mind when I'm writing, but I thought it was good. I thought it was okay. But then I just started thinking it could be even better. And then suddenly it just came to me what I have to do, and so I completely rewrote the ending. And I think now the ending is actually a million times better. So. For Roadkill, I don't think now I would change anything. So, no.
You'll find out next week when you get your review from Guess Who, everybody, because I'm reading it. I wouldn't change a thing about my main characters.
Warts and all, I just let them be what they are. And for better or worse, all the blemishes, the warts, the scars, the this, the that, it is what it is, and it has to just live on its own now. The fledgling is out of the nest, and let it fly.
I think Marty, with all his warts and his past flaws and everything, that makes him who he is now.
That's right.
For your book. You know, like, that's what made Roddy so appealing, because he had such a tough upbringing, and he turned himself around, and here he is in this situation where he's got to use those skills again.
He's got to recall the mad dog, yeah.
Yes, the mad dog really came back.
Fran, I wouldn't change any of my characters. They're based on guys I've known them. I'm comfortable with them. The story revolves around them. Changes in my book would be stylistic. You know, maybe I want to write it a little differently, tighten it up a little bit here and there. But I think any errors, the readers will let me know. Well, if there's anything that needs to be changed, but I'm very comfortable with my characters and who they are.
I love your characters.
Really,
I agree,
great,
completely. I might want to change stylistically. My wife says to me, look, do you want to write a literary novel or a suspense thriller? I said, well, how about both? She says, no, you can't write a hybrid. No.
She says, you can't write a hybrid?
A hybrid, yes.
A little electric, people?
Curb the flowery language and all the gorgeous descriptions and just tell the story. That's all.
Yeah, that's what I think,
too. That's true. That is so true, because as a reviewer, you know, sometimes people embellish so much on the, okay, here's my question that's not on the page. Like I said, I've read so many books, and you include scenery and stuff, but sometimes there's so much scenery that I skip it and don't read it.
That's what Elmore Leonard said,
you
know.
I'm a great fan of a very famous author. I'm not going to name them, but they tend to spend an awful lot of time describing highways, roads, all that sort of business, right? Which way to go? Which direction? This and that, and it's just so incredibly boring. So I just.
I wonder if it's the same one I'm thinking of.
I don't know. And yet, by the same token, if I read a book by Cormac McCarthy, his descriptions of the is just so unbelievable. You are actually there. You can actually feel the place you're in, and I think his descriptions are just beyond compare. But this other, but this other guy with his roads and his highways, no thanks.
I know. Like I said, I'll read, you know, the book, and I'll say, oh my God, 17 pages of scenery. I'm going to skip it and get to the plot. And then I read a book like that the other day. I won't say what the name of it is. And it got to the point where I actually said, I really wish that you had done some more dialogue in the book, and that the characters had interacted more, and that the character really got let you get to know them more instead of telling me all about the scenery and stuff like that. And I didn't write a negative review.
I was
didn't exactly give it five stars either.
I was reading a book by a very famous and best-selling woman author who likes to play with the alphabet. And by the third or fourth page,
I know who that is.
By the third or fourth, the third or fourth page of the description of this apartment, I thought I was reading a decorator's magazine. I couldn't tolerate it. Now I realize I'm a guy, and maybe you know that stuff might appeal to women or to some women.
I
but
even
the story
got
was getting
enough.
Lost.
Enough already.
Yeah, the story was getting buried under all this detail.
Yeah.
Well, Fran, as you know, my books are really dialogue intensive. So if anything, I have the problem of maybe not providing enough description. My books are mostly...
No, you have enough.
Stay away from it. Mostly it's the dialogue between the characters.
That's why I can read them in zap time, because there's a lot of dialogue. And I think maybe because of the genre and because of what you write about that particular, because it's a police book, I think it would lose something if there was too much scenery in it.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just not my style also. I'm just kind of pithy to the point. That's just kind of how I write.
Okay.
I read an essay. I read an essay by Dennis Lehane. He was talking about what is now considered by many thriller writers to be a classic by George V. Higgins, The Friends of Eddie Coyle. And that book is about 19... Yeah, that book is about 90% dialogue, and according to Dennis Lehane, this is the way a crime story should be told, that all the frills are unnecessary. It sucks you right in, sweeps you up, and keeps you going to the bitter end.
Well, thank you, then. I must have hit the mark.
You did. I would have told you if you didn't. You know I would have said something. No, I read Mike's book, and then I did, you know, just told him what my opinion was, but, you know, never, what can I say? And I do that for certain people, not for everybody, because it does take, it's longer to do that than it is to write one of my, you know, very short, succinct reviews. What can I say? I try, but what can I tell you? Okay, new question. If you, as a new, you're all seasoned authors, and I've been doing this for a while, what are five things that all new authors should learn, should know about, and how do you feel when you get a review that you're not thrilled with? Does it really matter?
No.
Bad reviews don't matter.
Do not answer it. Do not be defensive.
No.
Just accept it. That's
I agree.
Let me tell you about a one star. Let me tell you about a one star review I received on Amazon. It get one star, and it said, "I could tell by the first page this was not for me. I closed the book," and she gave it one star.
I got two stars for the same. It must have been the same girl that gave me two stars and said, "I didn't read the whole book because I didn't understand it."
Yeah, well, that's a bit better than the one I got. I learned. It took me a little while, but I learned. Don't get all bent out of place over the bed. You know, even a detailed review that indicates the person read the book and didn't like it and points out 14 things that were terrible. It really boils down to taste, and you can't appeal to everybody.
That's right. That's why I won't pan a book, and that's why I won't give a bad rating. In other words, I won't give less than 3.5-4 stars. And if I feel that a book is not worth 3.5-4 stars, I'm just going to summarize it like I did to someone else's book the other day. And it's very funny because the author emailed me after he got my summary and thought the review was fantastic. And it was a great review. I just never said anywhere in the review that I liked the book or I disliked the book. Never said a word. And I was really glad that the person thought what was great. It's just that the characters were really all over the place, and the plot could have used a little bit more cohesiveness and believability. Other than that, it was fine. But I didn't want to say that.
But also, you have to always keep in mind about reviews, whether it's on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or whatever.
Yeah.
Different people have different reasons for writing reviews.
You
know, there is psychology to it. Some people are envious. Some people are admiring. Others, who knows? You can't take it to heart.
No,
you really can't.
You
really can't.
Seriously? I just basically, my whole thing is, if you're going to tell me that my books suck, that's fine. Tell me why they suck so I can improve on it. But mostly,
they probably don't know.
I haven't really gotten too many bad reviews, except for one person said I needed, right in the review, I needed to fire my editor.
That, well, you know what? I'll bring up that point. Be very honest. Delaney wants to know, and it's a good question. I was going to ask it. How do you use dialogue in your writing? I have read a whole lot of New York Times bestselling authors, as you know, and it's rare that you find a book that doesn't have some kind of syntax that you might disagree with, or some kind of grammar mistake that you're going to write it however the person said it, and it's not a grammar mistake. You might use a specific slang or a specific language. And you know what? Every book I've read, maybe six or seven, have not had a grammar mistake or a typo or something like that. Big deal. You can't worry about it. And I've had that criticism. Somebody said to me, oh, you know, you wrote this way. I said, well, that's how the character said it to me before she died. That was how she described what happened.
Yeah.
Delaney would like to know, how do you use dialogue in your story in order to keep the right balance between, you know, narrative and dialogue?
I have a simple rule about that. I didn't invent this phrase. I heard it from somebody, and I think it really holds true. Dialogue is not what people say to each other. It's what they do to each other with words. And I think if I stick to that, I'm going to create dialogue that crackles and that conveys tension, conflict, and keeps the story moving.
Well, in that case, I have to say, Mark, Kenny was really giving it to the other guys good in dialogue in the book, because he was brutal. He was just brutal, especially when he's on all those pills, and he was just brutal. He was just not letting anybody not have it.
That's right.
Well, Fran, as I was saying before, Fran, you know, to me, dialogue is king. And everything about that character is going to come out in the dialogue. And the syntax, the words he uses, the story he tells, that is the story, that is the character, and how they interact about these. It's the whole story is based on that dialogue.
Well, in other words, as a writing and reading staff developer, I should throw that in, people, and as an educator, just like Stuart, sometimes when you write, you could feel like the tone. As I'm reading your characters, Mike, I could tell the tone of voice. I can almost hear Mark's voice or the other detective's voice as I'm reading it. I could even hear Ronnie's voice. I could hear Megan's voice in the other book that Mark wrote. I could hear Laura sounding like Karen in Daytona Dead. I can hear in Splintered Eyes, I could hear the person that was crazy and the other characters. I've read all of Stuart's books just about. And Roadkill, like I said, is scaring me just after reading the first chapter. And I promise not to get too scared. I just won't read it before I go to sleep. That's it. But how do you set that tone so that when someone is reading the book, they could actually hear the way the character would say it? And that, to me, is a mark of a great author. If I can hear what the character is saying the way I think it should be said if it was in a movie or on a television show, how do you create that tone?
Well, see, then that's where mine comes from, the experience. I mean, I have two cops talking, or a cop and FBI to the young guys, the city in the car and surveillance. If they're not cursing and talking about women and sex and those kind of things, it will not be real.
Absolutely.
Now, it may be offensive to somebody, and I try not to overdo it, but this is what we did as young men, you know, sitting in the cars and having hours to pass, and the things we say about people when we're done handling a complaint or making an arrest. That's the reality of who we are. And if I don't bring that out, the story won't be real, and I don't think it'll be impactful.
In my previous life, I used to do a lot of acting, and obviously, so that in a way has sort of framed the way I write with my characters, the way they speak. And what I do is, after I've done that, it's almost like a dramatic piece, I suppose, because then I actually read it out loud. So I read the different characters, and I get the intonation of the voice, And if then I can begin to change the dialogue, make it a bit more, you know, more realistic in that way. But that's what I do, and it's I find that is a really, really powerful tool, that just by actually reading it aloud, and it just brings up so many different, well, I wouldn't say mistakes, but perhaps things that you could have added or maybe even taken out with dialogue. And I just find that really useful.
Would you read the dialogue with another person?
No. I read it all myself, and I put on different voices as well.
Yeah, I find that... I find that writing fiction is not only a creative process, it's an auditory process and a visual one. I hear the words as I'm writing them.
Yes.
I see the scene as I'm writing it. It's alive and vivid in front of my eyes and in my ears, in my head. I can't imagine not hearing and seeing and feeling what the characters are hearing, seeing and feeling.
Yeah. And I think by doing that, Mark, you create that reality within the writing. I think
maybe
that's
why I'm schizophrenic.
like in Love Gone Mad. Slightly.
What made you
decide, Mark, to sort of give it away in a sense, in the next one?
When you say give it away, I'm not...
In other words, you sort of saw it at the end, and the ending was interesting, was very interesting. But you sort of know the person that you said with Megan, you sort of figured that out.
Oh, yeah.
I was surprised.
Yeah,
How come you did it that way?
It was just a twist. I mean, the idea was... would terrible things happen to Megan and or Adrian, and if so, what would they be? Would they get away? Would evil prevail or madness prevail? What's that fine line between evil and madness? And then toward the end, it's not a matter of would they get away anymore, but my God, how did this come about? What were the circumstances that really came together over the course of years and years and years that made all of this come to a head and erupt as it did? Fran, you know the answer to that now, but I just thought it'd be a different. It'd be a different angle to take. It wasn't a whodunit; it's a how it was done, how it came to be, and right down to the very last page. You don't have a full understanding until something is discovered.
Well, that's why I didn't want to read that late at night either, because I'd have another nightmare. I mean, between your book, Stuart's book, and Mike's murders, I mean, really.
I received the ultimate compliment from Scott Pratt, the author of the Joe Dillard series of legal thrillers. He reviewed it for a blurb, and he said, "This book is Stephen King scary." Just to have
Stephen King's name
affixed to something.
Stuart's books are Stephen King scary, too.
Yeah,
Alfred Hitchcock scary.
Yeah,
wow,
yeah.
That's cool. Thank you, friend.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes,
I know a mystery author, Alyssa Grodin, whose next book is going to be called Murder by Hitchcock.
She's got to send that. You've got to tell her to send it to me, because that's
my kind
of book.
I will.
Okay, but before we end, I have one more question, and I want everybody, okay, my next question is, what's next for everybody?
Wow. Well, for me, Fran, I'm just finished working on a novel called Varangian, which is an historical thriller, and it's about a guy called Harald Hardrada, who was he invaded England in 1066, and he had the most amazing life, and he was the lover of the Empress of Constantinople, and in his youth. And I wrote this story, and I submitted it to a publisher, and they've taken it on, and it's just fabulous, and I love it. And I'm already writing the next one, but it's full of murder and plenty of I was going to say how's your father, but that's an English expression. It's full of sex, sex and violence, and it's like the old days. It's like the old
when
days
is this
of Rome,
supposed
but it's
to come
all
out?
In context.
And when is this supposed to come out?
Well, ooh, fingers crossed, maybe August.
Oh, I'm sure I'll see it before, right, or after.
Well, I'm hoping
I'm
August.
Sure
yeah, that's my big project at the moment, yeah.
And what about you, Mark? What's you're writing the sequel to?
Well, September 1st of this year, Love Gone Mad comes out, and I'm really looking forward to that and lining up lots of talks. And then literally 9 months later, which is a perfect gestation period, Mad Dog Justice, the sequel to Mad Dog House, will be coming out. And then after that, I have three more in the can, but... right now, Love Gone Mad, followed by Mad Dog Justice, and there too, as with Karen, I had to make it a standalone novel, but also give enough backstory so that the new reader has a sense of what preceded it.
Well, Mark's coming back on the show in September, right? You're doing the 19th or the 26th, one of them, I know you are. We're going to talk about Love Gone Mad, and we're going to really get into that book, people, so just be there. And if you didn't read it, you should read it if you have any questions. And Karen, what's next for you? What am I reading next? Who's going to die next and where?
Right now I am working on a book called Dead Men Don't Swing, where Laura's actually gone back to school to become a CSI because she's such a book magnet, armchair detective, why not get paid for it? And then somebody who I used to work for is the victim in that one. Well, the model of the victim.
Well, Karen promised to put me in one of her books, and so did Christina.
I just don't know when that's going to happen yet.
That's okay, because there are more stones that Fran's going to write about someday soon. Okay, I have one final question. Mike, what's next
yes.
for you? Wait a minute. I don't want to forget
oh.
Michael.
Well, I've been... my microphone fell off. Sorry about that. I've been in discussions with an actor and a TV producer who have expressed some interest in Midnight Sin and Bad Intent for possibly a TV series or a movie deal. And we're just talking right now, but I want to at least pursue that. We'll see how that plays out.
And
that's
got to be
movie,
exciting.
I want a front row seat. I want a front row seat.
Well, talk is easy. Talk is easy.
You just never know. Okay, I have one more last question before we wrap up. Let me just remind everybody that next Thursday at 4, New York Times bestselling author Laura Griffin will be here, and the novel is Exposed, and yeah, you want to read it. Followed by Mr. Joe, Joseph Barnett and his sister Jane wrote a book about Joe's experiences with ghosts, and it's real, and he really did see them, hear them, and worked in a school that was haunted. So I am totally excited about that. And Joe, if you're listening, this is a lot of fun, so don't even worry about the questions. We'll just chat and see where everything goes. Okay, one last question I just thought of. If you could put a historical figure or a figure from literature in your book as either a protagonist or a good or somebody evil, who would you pick and why? I just thought
that's a great question.
I put Harold Hadrada in mine, and I would do again. Because he's huge, he's about 6'10". He's incredibly violent. He's incredibly passionate, and he doesn't care a single damn about anybody. So he's the perfect villain,
cool.
And I put him in there every time.
Anybody else? If you could pick a historical figure or a character.
I gotta go with J. Edgar Hoover. But there's so much has been written about him already.
Oh, you should. You should.
I'll have to come up with my own twist.
This has been done before, but I'd love to do it. I'd love to put Sigmund Freud as the ultimate sleuth.
Oh, well, he's in that is so cool, because one of the books I'm reading right now was dealt with Sigmund Freud. That is interesting. I like Sigmund Freud. I like reading, all stuff
he,
like
he
that.
He really
too.
Was
yeah.
the ultimate sleuth, the ultimate explorer of mysteries in the mind, yeah.
You see, and I like Hercule Poirot.
You could have him in a novel with Carl Jung. You could have him and Carl Jung, and they could fight over things, and that would be really cool.
Yeah, they could hook up and kind of pursue who knows what, or at least give the police some insight, you know.
Yeah.
Wasn't there a recent movie with Freud?
Yes, there was a movie, I think it was the 3% solution or one of those.
Yeah.
I forget. Yeah. It's been done before.
There's not one with Carl Jung. So we'll have to write one about Carl Jung. Definitely.
Yeah, that would be really very interesting.
But as a shrink, I think I could do a good job with it, you know.
Yeah.
Except
he probably could.
You see, Mark, I gave you something for your next book.
Yeah, he didn't curse enough though, you know.
If
Sigmund
Freud and Carl Jung met Mark Rubenstein, what would happen? Okay, well, everybody, Michael, where can we get all of your books and what are the titles?
MichaelTabman.com. And, you know, my first book is a nonfiction, which is just lessons learned based on my 27 years in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, full of true stories. And then, of course, Midnight Sin and Bad Intent, as we spoke about today. And thank you very much for the opportunity.
You're welcome. And when the book comes out, I want a real copy so I could do a real review. So then you can have you back on again, and I can actually ask some more real questions about the book.
Absolutely.
And Mark has to come on the show too.
I've asked him that, and he's willing to do it.
Oh, that is good, because he's the real detective that the stories are based on. So, you know, he's got to come, and this way he can tell me if you got it right or wrong.
Okay, very good. Okay.
Mark, where can we get all of your books?
They are, there are five nonfiction books that are floating around all over the universe, but the novels are, of course, thus far, Mad Dog House Soon, Love Gone Mad. They are available on Amazon, they're available in bookstores, and they're available on any reading device on Earth for the life-altering price of $2.99. And that's I'm really trying to make a killing on this, and that's pretty much it, you know.
What can I say? And what about yours, Karen? Where can we get your books and Stuart's books?
Dead Comics Standing Over Her Dead Body and Daytona Den are all available on Amazon in all formats. And also, I have my very first album of charted adults, Dead on Arrival, is available through me. So if you want to read it, and it's only in print, so just Facebook me or email me. And, you know, just enjoy, please.
That book is hilarious, too. And, Stuart, where can we get all of your books?
Okay, well, all the normal places, as you've just heard, or on my website. You can go to my website, which is stuartgyates.com. I've got four books written as me. That's The Sandman Cometh, Splintered Ice, Burnt Offerings, and my latest, which is Roadkill. But as Glenn Stewart, I've got another 10 novels published. So if you like paranormal mysteries, you can go to glennstewart.co.uk.
Yeah, I read Interlopers from Hell, because that was really scary, too, and kept me up
and
gave me nightmares. Yeah, awesome.
I like that. Yeah, it was cool.
And I'll be
reading as well.
And I'll be reading and reviewing Daytona Dead in the next couple of days.
Mark, you're gonna have to join my review site. Stuart's part of it, Michael's part of it, and Karen reviews on my review site. You're gonna have to do it on Facebook. If you Facebook me and friend me, I could put you on reviewing your book, Outstanding Authors, Positive Viewpoints, Nothing Nasty, No Bad Reviews Are Allowed. Seriously.
Okay.
And you can
post your
links and anything you want.
And I'll find you on Facebook,
and I'll join
right?
You up.
I'll just type in Fran Lewis. I'll get you.
Unfortunately, you'll get me. Unfortunately, you might get me there. What can I tell you?
Well, I'm a stalker. You know that. I'll stalk you.
Yep. I've had that problem recently, and there were two stalkers on my emails asking me to review their books, praying that I'll say yes, and I don't know how I'm going to tell them. They're going to have to wait forever, because I've got like 30 books inside, and I have to read Roadkill. And I have to read Timothy Lewis's Baker's book, because it's short and it's really cute and it's good and it's got murder in it.
It is a really cute It is a really good book. And another one I recommend.
It's good, isn't it?
Timothy's is where North meets South and
you
East.
You read that
meets
one?
West.
Oh, I
it's
didn't
very
read that
interesting
one
as well. It's more of an autobiographical account of what he went through.
Oh, good.
His life so far. So it's really interesting. It's a bumpy ride, so buckle up. But I really did enjoy it.
I read the other one, the one about Florida, Fun in Florida, Fantastic Florida.
Oh, Fantastic Florida Fun. It's short, sweet, to the point, but it's a good story.
It was a good story, and what I really like about the fact is that I could read that really fast later and write a nice review tomorrow. And on that note, I want to thank everyone. And we will be back next week, like I said, with Laura Griffin and Joe Barnett. And the week after, on June 20th, is my last show until August. I have New York Times bestselling author Rayanne Thame with her brand new book that's not out yet, Willow Leaf Lane. And in August, we will start up again, and I just hope Bethany's here. We're going to be so excited. Iris Johansson is our first interview. I just have to firm up the date. And we have Mark Rubenstein in September, and we have Alan Topol in September. And who knows, I just booked somebody for October, people. Seriously. The guy that wrote The Tragedy of Louis XVI, David Lane, the play, the Shakespearean play written about Louis XVI. That should be interesting. And on that note, I will say goodnight and thank you so very much, everybody. I appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Thank you, Bethany.
Thank you, Fran, and thank
have
you
a
all.
Great,
yeah.
You're welcome.
Thank you, everybody.
And Bethany, have a great vacation and everybody, goodnight.
Yes,
all
goodnight.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.